Get started. Was that my yes get going? Thank you, everyone, for coming. This is the work session for our May 7th, 2024 meeting. Apologize for getting started late, but it's hard to get me to smile and fill those pictures. So, Wayne, have you eaten enough to start? Our first item is discussion related to the homelessness, and now I'll turn it over to Elisa to introduce our guest.
Thank you. So I'm thrilled to have Wayne Niederhauser join us tonight. He and I met over a year ago, I think, at the Healthy Utah Conference, where they were presenting on a variety of things, quality of life. And one thing I've brought up in City Council a few times is just a concern that we are aware and are coordinating resources for unhoused individuals in our community or who come to our community. I feel like this is a really pending issue, and I'm excited to hear about what resources are out there, the scope of what is available, and then have a discussion among us about where we can jump in and provide some resources and some leadership there. So this is Wayne Niederhauser from the governor's office.
Thank you very much, and I appreciate this opportunity. And I just have to say that Lisa and I, we grew up in Logan together and graduated from high school, and so appreciate her and friendship and association. I guess you have my slides? Okay. Okay. There we go. Go back here. First of all, let me just tell you a little bit about myself and how I got into this spot. I've lived in Sandy ever since I graduated from Utah State, became a CPA, and then got into real estate development because being a CPA is boring. So, And we've developed projects. Actually, we've done some in North Salt Lake before, so been around here. And then got this, a friend of mine came to me and asked me to run for the legislature, and I somehow was successful. It was the hardest thing I'd ever done times 10 to get elected in Sandy, and was in the Senate for 12 and a half years, six of those as the Senate president. And then I left on my own accord before that was an involuntary leaving, and went back to my private sector job in the real estate community. And when you're a former legislator, everybody wants you on some kind of a board somewhere. And so I said yes too many times and was involved in homelessness a little bit, and we ran a bill in 2021 to create the Office of Homeless Services and have a coordinator because we needed a more focused attention on homelessness, a lot of problems. And so that office was created in 2021, and then the governor called me and says, hey, why don't you be the state coordinator? I said, well, I didn't really want to do that, but when the governor calls, you do need to respond. And my wife and I decided this would be a great opportunity. And I have to say that when I got into this position, I didn't know a lot about homeless services. It's kind of interesting, you know, why would the governor ask you if you don't have a lot of experience with homelessness? Well, he knew that we would need to get budgets approved and bills passed through the legislature, and that I did know pretty well, actually. So that's probably the reason I was put in this position, but I knew when I went into this job that I didn't know about homeless services. So for the first 4 months, I went from St. George to Logan to Vernal and Twilla and every place in between, and I visited domestic violence shelters, our shelters across the state. There's one in St. George, a major one in Ogden, and then all the ones in Salt Lake, and some minor shelters like in Twilla the most prolific or the most common shelter is domestic violence shelters throughout Utah. Sadly, that's what we have. That's what we need. And then we also, my wife and I, decided to get to know this a little bit better. We knew a lady that spent time with people on that are unsheltered on the street. And so we started every Friday night going out to a community of unsheltered population in Salt Lake City in the Sugar House area and offering a meal. And just, you know, we didn't want to enable, but sometimes people need a blanket to survive, some shoes or something. And so we started with this lady, and together us three visit this community of unsheltered folks every Friday night, except for we're on vacation or something. And I've gotten to know people. I've probably gotten to know over 100 people, and got to a point where they trust you and are able to. We're able to communicate about, you know, what happened in your life that you're experiencing homelessness, and the stories are very troubling to me. And I've done a lot of reading or listening. I listen to books quite a bit as I'm doing other things. And I really focused on mental illness, and then of course substance abuse is a big issue in the homeless community, but trauma is really the core issue with a person's life, that where they get to a point where their lives are unregulated, and they end up in homelessness. In fact, homelessness is the catch-all for all the troubles and ills in society. That's where everybody lands. You don't get lower than that in society. It's homelessness. And so this is what we're dealing with. And how do we deal with this? And we do it compassionately, but yet with expectations and accountability. So first of all, homelessness is a community condition. And it's going to take community to remedy it. Every community is a source of homelessness. You may not think that, but people become homeless in every community, whether they're evicted, whether they're experiencing a mental illness. I don't know how many families I've talked to about their child that. And this happens especially with schizophrenia in the late teenage years and early 20s, when that mental illness really starts to show up in a person's life. And so many of those individuals then end up in homelessness. The family can't take care of them, or they don't want to be taken care of. But they're on the street, and then they self-medicate, and that's just one scenario. The scenarios are hundreds of different ways this happens to an individual. So I always ask the question, this is a community condition, and every community is a source of it. We have people that I meet on the street and always ask where they went to high school. They're from all over the state, and mostly from the state. There's a misconception out there that people are sending people here. That does happen occasionally. You may have seen the headline that Jackson Hole was sending people that were homeless to Salt Lake City, and yes, they did send some people there. That we did verify that. But mostly people are from Utah that end up in homelessness. So what is your community doing to prevent and treat this most human condition? Most difficult human condition, because if we can meet it or prevent it, it would be better than trying to get people out of the crisis of homelessness. So just a couple of data points, and I want to highlight that there are really two distinct homeless populations out there, a more transitional population and a persistent homeless population, and those are terms according to Wayne. There are official definitions out there, but they are confusing to me, and I'm trying to simplify this. and compartmentalize it for me and for what we're trying to do as a state. So we know there's a transitional population because in 2022, 28,000 unduplicated people accessed homeless services across the state of Utah. So providers that we fund or the federal government fund, they're required to report into what is called HMIS. It's the Homeless Management Information System. And so we have a lot of data. And we know all these numbers are low, okay, because not everybody reports. Not everybody gets money from the federal government. Some operate without government money. But what we know from those who report is that 28,000 people accessed homeless services. We do a point in time count every year. You may have heard of this, maybe even participated in it. I run into a lot of people that participate, and if you haven't participated, I encourage you to do so. Davis County has a point in time count, and they're always looking for volunteers, or you could volunteer in Salt Lake County since you're so close. But that point in time count, it's easy to count those in shelter because we know everybody that's in shelter. But we know that the unsheltered population is undercounted, but we attempt to try and do that. And in the 2023 point in time count, there was almost 3,700 people that were counted on a January night. It's a specific night. We also know that our data shows that 77% of the people that come into shelter are there less than 90 days, and almost a third are there less than 7 days. And so we know we have a transitional population because on any given night, we have probably about 4,000 people that are in shelter or unsheltered. What happened to the rest of the 28,000? What happened to the rest of, I didn't give you this data point, but the other data point is, which always concerns me, is we had 9,000 people in 2022 experience homelessness for the first time in the state of Utah. And that seems to be on its way up. And there's a lot of reasons for that, and I'll talk a little bit about that also. But we know that there's this transitional population. They get into homelessness and they get right back out, mainly because they don't have any co-occurring issue, disability, that makes it more difficult to get out of homelessness. They get in, they get out. But we have this what is called persistent homeless population. And these are the people I see every Friday night. Many of them have been in housing multiple times. Many of them have been in treatment multiple times, and they're having multiple incidents with the criminal justice system. Our police force, and we appreciate all that they do, are usually the frontline people that are out there that are the first people that our law enforcement officers are the homeless people first interact with them. And sometimes there's criminal behavior going on with the homeless population and where they're trying to encamp, try to stay. They're trying to find a place to sleep and set up a temporary housing situation. So, those who are there, I split it into two, the persistent homeless population, those who are ready to get into homeless housing and services, and those who are not. And I first have to say this. Unsanctioned camping, what you see on Victory Road, up on the side of the hill, what you see downtown, what you see on the Jordan River Parkway trail system, is the worst thing we can accept as society. Why? People are living in places not fit for human habitation. There's public health and sanitation issues. They're frequently abated because of that issue. People are victimized, especially women, in these encampments. There is a predatory population, and then most of the people are preyed upon in these encampments. And it creates public conflicts. You know, people don't feel safe to ride their bike along the Jordan River Parkway trail system. And then it's against the law. We have no camping ordinances. But we really haven't answered a few questions, and that is, where do people go if they're not sheltered? And so I want to start this conversation about the homeless system with the sources of homelessness. This is not exhaustive, but we've split it into three systems: life events and lack of attainable or affordable housing. You can see I won't go over all those, and you have my slides to refer to in the future. But these are the sources of homelessness. Somebody mentioned about foster care just a few minutes ago. I can't remember who I was talking to about that. But 37% of the children who age out of foster care end up in homelessness. And, you know, we've got to do something about that. And I'm all up about going upstream. There's a book called Upstream. It's a great read about prevention. And one of the first things that the author does is talks about these two men who are walking along a river, and they see a child floating down the river and a drowning situation. They jump in and rescue that child, and they see another one, then they see another one, and they see another one. They're frantically in a crisis trying to save these children. And then one of them leaves, and the other says, "Where are you going?" "I'm going upstream to find out who's throwing the kids in the river and stop it." And that's the mentality that we need to have here. And that's things like my hometown, the West Valley and Ogden, some others, as a community building resiliency in our neighborhoods so that there's support and help. Neighbors are helping one another and supporting one another. And I think that's part of the reason why it's part of the reason why we have less resilient communities, because we're all connected somewhere to the internet, or and we're not out with each other as much. There's not as much community. And a reinvigoration of community, I think, will be a help in prevention. We've mapped out the system. It's a lot more complicated than this, but I like to compartmentalize and simplify. And that green box is so critical. Those three blue boxes at the top are what I just showed you in the previous slide. And if we can prevent it from happening in the beginning, we're going to save ourselves a lot of money and a lot of grief. Now, that may be altruistic, but I believe that we really need to address it where it starts, because once they cross that beige bar into homelessness, they're in crisis. They're in crisis. The system is in crisis because it's always underfunded, always under-resourced, and it's just a system of crisis. That transitional population, they're in shelter less than 90 days and back out into housing, either through being self-resolved or through system supports. Our systems are actually working. A data point, 8,000 people, individuals, found housing through our shelter system over the last 4 years. We should applaud that. You know, a lot of times the shelters are, they get the bad rap that they're not taking care of the people that are in there. The people that are in there have free will, by the way, and have rights. And there's only so much you can do with people if they're unwilling. But 8,000 people got into housing. There's that persistent homeless population. Those who are ready, let's get them into housing. and with the support they need. Some will need high support. Some will need lower support. On that continuum of mental health in the green box, on the one end, you have the state hospital, and then on the other end, you have permanent supportive housing. We have 2,300 chronic people. There are people experiencing chronic homelessness. That is some kind of a co-occurring issue, like disability, mental illness is pervasive. And if we can address the mental health continuum better, we will take a big bite out of homelessness. And that's getting the care that they need. There's a great book called Healing by Dr. Insel. He was the director of of mental health for the United States through the Obama administration and Bush 2 administration. And then he writes a book about everything that he did wrong that he's discovered that is right now. It's a great read on where our system lacks. And essentially what's happened is we closed asylums because of the egregious things that were happening in asylums in the 60s and 70s, probably even into the 80s. But we didn't replace them with anything, except the default was incarceration from one asylum to another, or homelessness. So it's a complicated situation, but people that get into a criminal situation, if it's not a felony that would, where they're a risk to society, diversion into what they need is a better system. So there's a response called the sequential intercept model, and we took a group down to Dade County, which is Miami. Dade County is doing an amazing job with this diversion program, getting people, diverting them from jail into treatment and resources that they need. They have funding to do it. You got to have those resources. But the homelessness in the Miami area has gone down significantly, and they're addressing mental health and behavioral health issues by diversion. So mental health, diversion from the criminal justice system, and housing are some of the key elements, and community, developing more resilient, supportive communities. I'm a real estate developer, and so I've done a number of housing projects done hundreds of pro formas. I know what it takes to make a housing project work. And deeply affordable housing, which is 30% area median income and below, it doesn't pencil, not even close. It will never naturally happen. It'll never attract the capital because it's an expense. And so it has to be supported. And with some other people that are smarter than me, we created this housing model where let's use the systems we already have. Low-income housing tax credit, Medicaid with housing resource services. Those programs will work if we utilize them correctly. And they're already funded to a large degree, mostly from the federal government. The gaps would be one-time funding and maybe some rent support. We were very successful in getting some one-time money out of the legislature for these funding gaps and for some rent support, and it's created through our grant process about 1,600 additional units for homelessness. The problem with it is the Kim Gardner Institute at the University of Utah finished a study last fall that shows that we have a 77,000 unit deficit for deeply affordable housing. For workforce housing, which is 50% AMI to 80% AMI, 160,000 unit deficit. So to put in more perspective, workforce housing, if your income is in the 50 to 80% area median income, for every 100 households, there are 50 units available for them. For deeply affordable, for every 100 households, there are 3 units available. So housing is a central issue to all this with the proper support. And the data also supports this. California has the highest rate of homelessness, 44 people per 10,000. When you look at a state of 38 million people, that's a lot of people that are experiencing homelessness. Surprisingly, Mississippi has the lowest rate of homelessness, 5 per 10,000. What's up with that? When you look at the Midwest as a region, they have the lowest rates of homelessness. The West Coast has the highest rate of homelessness. Now overlay that with the cost of housing, and it matches identically. At its core, this is a cost of housing issue. It's not the only issue, but transitionally, situationally, and chronically, it is a central issue to homelessness. It's the antithesis of homelessness, having a house. So that's the data there. Some others, we're 11 per 10,000. Alabama, again, some of the southern states where you've got lower cost of housing, you have less homelessness. There's just another data point. The lack of housing is so great in our state that most people that get into homelessness or are trying to get out have to wait over 365 days. You can see that's the 7,300, 7,400 number there, and sometimes it's years for a unit to come available that they can afford. That's the data there, 77,000. This is from the Kim Gardner Institute. They did a study, statewide study, on affordable housing. It's a really good study. You can see if you add the 68,000, the 95,000 together, that's your workforce housing deficit in the state. Fortunately, some have been in their housing for a long time, but if everybody was homeless today and buying housing, that would be the deficit at the current prices for housing. This is just another graphic of housing. Let's take Davis County, for example. 30% area median income for an individual in Davis County is $22,350. Affordable rent for that for them, 30% is $559. Fair market rent, that's not fair market rent. That's what HUD designates as fair market rent, and it's low, by the way, is $1,032. So it's $473 a month that has to be subsidized in order for people to have that housing. If you look at it as a family, it's $1,000 a month. This is just a chart. You know, I won't get into this a lot, but this is just these are the different, what I would call, I guess, different types of housing and where they fit in the continuum. Market rate being on the right side there or left side, whichever way you're looking at the purple. And emergency shelter being on the other side, and all the other housing in between. You can see homelessness to housing strategies are the yellow to the deep or to the dark green. Affordable housing strategies are the blue to the kind of the pinkish color there. Another important element to let me go to this one first. Another thing that we've done in the Office of Homeless Services is create a statewide strategic plan. And the statewide strategic plan was a one-year process. We hired Homebase to come in. They did focus groups and went all over the state from St. George to Logan, from the east to the west, and interviewed people that were homeless, experiencing homelessness, providers, police departments, and a strategic plan came out of that, and it focuses on four issues: housing, services, coordination, and prevention. So we're in the midst now. We have this. We've had this plan now for a year. We've accomplished some of the things that are on there, but we have a long way to go. And I'm really excited about going upstream and trying to prevent homelessness in the first place. But one of the things we also have to focus on is coordination. So we are actually, we do pretty well here in the state. HUD, Housing and Urban Development, designates geographical areas called COCs, Continuum of Cares organizations. And there are three of those in the state of Utah. One is Salt Lake County itself, and Salt Lake County is the sponsoring organization. Mountain Land is Summit Utah and Wasatch. They are a COC. And having a COC designation, you get certain funding from the federal government and other support. And then the balance of state is the rest of the state, and the state is the sponsoring entity. And that's the part that Davis County would be in. And then we've divided it up into what are called local homeless councils, because it doesn't do us good to do all this from Salt Lake City. So Ogden Morgan has their own homeless council. They get together, they coordinate, and if they're doing it right, they're doing it on a by-name list and bringing the support of the community around every individual and trying to help them get out of homelessness and back into housing and thriving as much as possible. There'll be some people that will be taken care of the rest of their lives who have a severe and persistent mental illness. Let's see. I'll just leave this with you. This is just the resource center model. It's a holistic approach to addressing people's needs and people that are experiencing homelessness. Our resource center model was the model that we put in place after the road home at Rio Grande, after that was all disrupted by the legislature and in Salt Lake County in 2018. I was Senate president at the time. But the outcomes have been mixed, mainly because of the resources being the lack of the resources. But it was good that we closed down that shelter downtown. People were being stacked in there. There was a lot of egregious things happening to people. And the shelter system now functions so much better than it did 5 years ago or 6 years ago. But that's just a resource for you to look at. Our office is a resource to you as a city, and we're more than willing to offer any support that we have. And if you'd like to reach out to us after this for any reason, we can help. We're happy to do that. The legislature passed House Bill 298 this last year and created the Homeless Services Board. It used to be a 29-member council, and we now have 11-member board. I think that'll be smaller and a little bit more nimble. So we're excited about what's going to happen. Those appointments have all been made, and our first meeting is next week on Thursday. So we're anxious to get started and work on accountability issues, housing issues, just a better continuum of care for people experiencing homelessness. If we still have time, I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you. That was so informative and helpful. And while you were speaking, I jotted down several ideas where I feel like we could intersect, especially in the prevention side and also in the intervention work. My question is, have you, with other smaller sized cities, seen them do anything in particular that you noted was that's a great way to really make a difference in housing in your city or for homelessness in general? Have you seen any models for cities that what they've done?
My hometown, the West Valley, started with a religious community, with religious communities, building resiliency in neighborhoods, getting people to help one another, I think is a tremendous model of building strong community. When somebody's in a crisis, the community supports them, and they're not left to deal with the crisis alone. These are the sources of homelessness. If those things aren't addressed, the support isn't there. You know, I think we have a lot of that built into our system here in Utah just because of the religious communities that are out there, which help to create that community, that support. But cities like West Valley, Ogden, and others who, I think Provo now is doing that, doing that program. I look at South Salt Lake, what they're doing for children there, supporting their rates of graduation and so forth have increased substantially because of a program that Mayor Wood in South Salt Lake have implemented. I'm trying to remember the name of it. But those are the kind of responses I think that communities need to have. Housing, obviously, is a big deal. But, you know, the legislature hasn't seen fit to give us the resources, the cities, the counties. They want you to have affordable housing, but it isn't just going to happen with the sweep of the wand. the legislature is going to have to give cities the resources to be able to create those affordable housing. And you know, it's hard because you get a lot of NIMBYism with that. But guess what? Those people that are in the workforce housing are our kids coming out of school trying to find a place to live and that may be living in your basement until they can afford a house. And it's getting worse because the wage gap and the cost of housing in Utah has been going like this. And unless that, you know, I don't think it can go on forever or it will be really devastating, but we got to address it as a state. It's probably one of the top three issues of our state, affordable housing.
Thank you. That's really helpful.
Any other questions for Wayne? Well, thank you so much for coming, and thank you for what you're trying to do.
Thank you.
In our state and in our communities.
Reach out if there's anything else we can do.
I think I will be. Thank
okay.
you.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank Thanks. You so much for being here.
Next item is Camille coming with her hat in her hand.
What?
Nothing.
Well, thank you, Mr. Niederhauser. I'm coming to talk about creating community as well, and my enthusiasm for this mural project is a little curbed thinking of talking about creating place when some people don't have a place. So I'll try to transition quickly to that then. Thank you for getting us on the agenda. It's good to see everyone. Thanks for what you do. We'll just go ahead and look at the slides. These are slides that we presented at the Parks and Arts Committee last time we met, and we have permission or approval or go get them from the committee to present that to you. So let's talk about creating place. Discover Davis has a mural grant program, and we recognize, and they recognize, that the economic impact of having art in our community is great. It brings a community together, and it offers a valuable local visitor experience, and it will help people come to our area and create that. If you go to the next slide, we want to talk about Discover Davis Discovering North Salt Lake. I know they're helpful with newsletters and pushing our events out, but other than Lakeview Printing on Highway 89 here, we are mural-free. We are a mural-free city, but we have a lot of opportunity to discover North Salt Lake with this program. So let me talk to you about what it entails. The mural grant overview would be that what we need is a business to offer their space and $10,000, and the number of 10,000 is because that is what Discover Davis will match. And so could North Salt Lake match that? Is a question I want you to be thinking about. A building, we need a very large building. We do have one located with an owner that has said they are interested in seeing if we can put this trifecta together of a business, the grant, and the city, which is, I think, would be preferred when it is, I'm going to call it juried, I'm not sure if that's the right word, but when things are chosen where monies will go, that is the perfect trifecta if the city's involved as well. So I'm excited that we've got a picture of that coming up, but we do have somebody who would like a business that would like to participate. And we do need to discover a painter, a muralist. I just went to the South Salt Lake Mural Fest. I'm not thinking we're going to bring anybody from far away, but boy, it was sure exciting. Let's go to the
Camille,
next.
Camille, can I ask a question on that slide?
Yes.
What is the cost of putting a mural in that we're trying to get to?
Let me show you this next picture, and I think I can talk with the numbers. So this is Expedition Trailers, and this, thank you for the picture, Ken. This is the view from Redwood Road, and we estimated that this entire wall would be like an $80,000 wall. But with what's available in this grant, the representative I spoke with there thought that they would even be interested in, you know, that first panel or the first two panels, whatever they could afford. But it's estimated that it's about $1,000 per square foot is what is on the Discover Davis website. But that also depends on the muralist that you get. And we don't want to not pay our muralists, but it will depend on who's brought in for that. So this is where I'm supposed to, you know, give the ask, I guess. But the ask would be, could we match that money if we have that package to put together all these things to bring some color to Redwood Road and beyond? That this could be something that we continue to do with Davis, Discover Davis, or right now that's what the ask is for that program. But I think it would also be a great way to kick off that program and bring some color and some other places to life around the city, as well as, so I drove around there and I just spotted like 9 businesses that I thought would be prime for this. So, did you hear my ask? Did I ask properly? Because I can ask louder.
Quick question.
Yes.
Camilla, what is the deadline for the grant?
Great question. The 2024 grant opens at the end of this month, and I think it's just a 3-week window. So I think there could be a lot of groundwork done before that opens.
And how many do they pick, and do they do this every year?
So far it's been just the 2 years that I'm aware of it. And I guess, I don't know what their budget is, but they select different within the county, those that fit the bill. I don't know what their budget is, but I know they're matching up to 10 grand. Were you thinking maybe we could do more?
Well, I was just wondering, that spot in like 13th South and 3rd West, kind of by the Walmart, there's several buildings, and so I was wondering whether they were part of a Salt Lake program like this.
Oh, that sounds like at least the neighborhood. No, that's not quite South Salt Lake, but
a different grant.
And then a different grant.
Who has the input? Is it the building owner, the city, or the grant corporation on the subject matter?
Great question. It can't be advertising for the businesses, the building, but it needs to be a collaborative between those three. And there's examples on Discover Davis website of successful partnerships. Thanks, good questions. Did I answer all of them?
Camille, great presentation.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming. And I'm eager to endorse the idea of granting this money so that you have a matching $20,000 to do it. I know in some communities, they've run into problems. And for example, Kearns had one that they put up that turned out to be odd enough that it looked a little pornographic. And it wasn't properly vetted. You know, there wasn't enough of a rendering to begin with or whatever. And then Moab's trying to put one up. It takes contracts and making sure that the muralist does make some money. They're not just out there to do it for free. But I think when you look at communities all over the world, this enlivens and welcomes and it adds color to an otherwise bland existence. And a mural can be both thematic, but also can just be emotive. You know, when one goes through the airport, Great Salt Lake, now they've, Salt Lake City Airport, on both sides now they've got this beautiful mural down the long mile that we walk. And it's pretty, and it makes it more pleasant. And so I'm excited about this, and I know that it's a passion for you, that you love the arts, and the idea of making our community more beautiful is completely worthwhile. So thank you.
Thank you, Lisa.
I want to add to that. Thank you for this presentation. And I know personally how many years you've put into thinking about this and planning for this. And the level of organization to get it to this point is so impressive. I really think you and I might have talked about this in 2017. Was
Do
the
you
first
think
time.
We did?
I think so. Way back when you were chair of Parks and Arts. I think we talked, and I know having been on Parks and Arts, and I think most of the council member has been on that, that public art comes up over and over again as something that that committee wants. This is the first time I've really seen a path to do that directly and concretely, and I'm so excited. It has my full support.
Thank you. I appreciate your text that says, ask for money, Camille. Put it together. Ask the money. Thank you.
Another question, and that is, do we receive RAP tax funding, and what is the amount of money that we have?
So the city does collect a 1% sales tax as a city. So our voters voted that in. That's the equivalent of the RAP tax in Salt Lake County. So yes, we do. And how much it is, I don't know off the top of my head. It seems like it's in the $300,000 range, maybe.
And some of that's committed to our park bonds.
Committed obviously. To our park bond, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't want to add anything to that, is, Heidi.
Because it exceeds expectations regularly. Camille, I have... So I look at this picture, this blank canvas... sitting there and
that's just one of them.
I have a garage that's owned by the RDA, and they came in on the backside and put a mural up, and I thought, well, that's okay, you know, it was very colorful, not sure what it was, but it was colorful. And prior to that mural going up, if we got tagged or something, we would just take care of it really fast. Well, so the mural's been tagged several times, and the RDA came back to us and said, hey, the muralist will, for $6,000, fix this.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I can whitewash it for a lot cheaper than that.
Yeah.
And so I don't know that anything happened on it. And as I look at this, I think, it's easy to fix when it gets tagged. Is it going to be an ongoing problem? And I don't know how much of a problem we have.
There is a maintenance part of the contract with Discover Davis that there will be a decision of those parties who will maintain that.
Okay.
And I did walk the property with her, and I said, don't put sprinklers in here. Figure out what to do with this grass, but don't put sprinklers in here. Thanks, okay. TJ.
All right.
So I had a couple of comments too. I wish everyone could see the passion that you have for any project that you have, because I've been on the committee with you, and anything you put your mind to, you do with a lot of passion, and I think that's admirable. So thanks for what you do. I have a concern as well, because I thought that about the tagging, because that does look like... if we put something on there, would that say, I want to put something on there as well? And that would be a little bit scary. But so if we did something like that, would that open an opportunity to maybe give the canvas and then build upon that, so that the whole building could be built upon and then it would be finished and make a big canvas? And then also maybe let the city know that that was going to be a project, and let them know what we were doing there,
okay.
and what the money was being spent for, so that they understood maybe a little bit more what the project was.
Okay, first of all, thank you for the compliment. I heard that, but this is going to be about all y'all thinking the same thing that I'm thinking. I'm just here to present it to you. But is your question... somehow let the city know that this is a project, so that
what the money is getting spent for, of what we're making a decision for, as well, but because it's an ongoing project, right? It wouldn't be just one time. It would be something that would be one not not just one mural, it would be several.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, for this ask
for
right
this
now,
time, yes.
It's for one, but as we go on, it would, and maybe people would do it without the grant as well once they kind of got the spirit of it. I don't know.
So I'll just chime in and say, I love this.
Thank you.
I'm with it, and thank you, too. And the only thing I'd throw in the mix is I'd love us to, I assume a property owner would not want to pursue this if they have a longer-term plan to do something dramatically different with the property. But we ought to have that as a consideration. You know, let's put murals on buildings that we think will be there for a good chunk of time. So mm-hmm. I assume that's the case here, but just as a basic consideration. But mm-hmm. I don't know how we go about making the decision since it's not on the agenda. It's just part of the work session, but maybe that's...
I would recommend... Well, Ken, you're about to recommend something, so...
Well, no, I was just going to try to... I guess what I was going to say is... I think Camille is here to gauge support of the city council, and I think I've heard support, and so I think we'll put together an application through the Davis County program, and then we'll come back to the council with details if we need to, or we'll submit an application based on this property owner and building owner's cooperation. And maybe add some funds to the budget that you can approve in the next few weeks.
I think it would be helpful to know if we have some RAP tax money that's not allocated, not earmarked already for that. That would obviously...
We'll get that report back to you, too.
So that I understand what Ken was saying, putting the application together for the grant is something that we do really well as a city with grants. We have excellent people that do that. But I think it's a little bit more than that. I think Camille is actually asking for a commitment that we will put in the budget the matching funding for the grant. Even if we don't get the grant, we have a $10,000 line item in our budget for this. And if it doesn't happen this year, we've got that next year, the $10,000 carries over. Is that correct?
I like the way you said it better.
Yeah, but that's, I mean, it's. Yes. I think we're all on board. I mean, when it comes time for us to approve a budget, which is coming up soon here in June, this would be a line item that we would vote on.
Okay.
Thank you, Camille.
Yes, and speaking of people who say it better, Tammy, I'm sorry I didn't do anything with it. No, wait. Years ago, you mentioned it when I was chair. It just took us a while. Laura Call. Just had to say her name because she's the one that brought it up again. Okay, thanks.
Thanks. All right, let's take a five-minute break, and before we start city council.